Hi and welcome to What's Next. I'm Thomas Wenström, and on today's show you will meet a truly impressive guest, one of the pioneers of open source, Bob Young. Bob Young is the founder of Red Hat, the first company to make big money on open source and Linux. Today Bob has left Red Hat and he now runs another venture, Lulu.com. Lulu is a print-on-demand book publishing company. Bob Young, welcome to What's Next.
Thomas, a great pleasure to talk to you today.
The same. Can I just ask you, where are you in the world right now?
I'm actually in Raleigh, North Carolina today, although I have to get up to Canada for the Canadian football championships. The Grey Cup is being played on this weekend up in Toronto.
Where you own a football team?
I do. I got involved in my hometown football team in the Canadian Football League, went bankrupt a few years ago. And as a Hamilton Tiger Cat fan, I couldn't sit idly by, so I got involved, and I'm one of the owners of the Hamilton Tiger Cats football team. They are not playing in the championship this weekend, unfortunately.
So I have a lot of entrepreneurs listening to this show, and I can't really skip this question, although I think this is the one you get most of the times. So do you mind just telling the short version of how Red Hat got started? How did you figure out you could make money on open source code?
Okay, well, you have to remember that going all the way back, most entrepreneurs were trained in something other than being an entrepreneur. So if you talk to successful business builders, they typically started as lawyers who stumbled into a business, or maybe they were engineers, or maybe they were trained as accountants. In my case, my first job out of university was selling typewriters. I sold IBM Correcting Selectric, the old golf ball typewriters, if you remember them. So I think to this very day, come the revolution, I'll be back to selling typewriters or Fuller brushes door to door to you and all your listeners.
Is that your backup plan?
That's my backup plan, exactly. But that's sort of what my background. That's what I bring to the businesses that I start. And I'd spent most of my career, I started in typewriters, but the company I was with very quickly evolved into computer equipment. Typewriters were being replaced by word processors. This is in the early 1980s. So we evolved along with it, and I spent 17 years prior to starting Red Hat in the technology sector, mostly in the equipment finance business. So we rented mini computers and personal computers and this kind of equipment. A long shaggy dog story, but the second of the companies that I started when I was in the computer leasing business, we sold to a Canadian financial services company. That company then got into financial difficulty, and I found myself unemployed, working out of my wife's sewing closet in our home in Westport, Connecticut. But at the time, prior to that, when I was still working for Vernon Computer Rentals, I was running the New York office, and I was trying to figure out a back door into all the big financial services companies in New York, Citibank and Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, because they were all big users of Unix workstations, and that was our focus, was to move upmarket from personal computers into these Sun Microsystems and Hewlett-Packard and IBM Unix workstations. So I would join all the Unix user groups. These were all your long-haired technicians who made all these systems work for the big banks in New York and the insurance companies in Boston and the government agencies down in Washington, D.C. And I would run a little a newsletter for the user groups that I called New York Unix, and I distributed this newsletter to the Unix users in Boston and New York and Washington in order to make friends with all the technicians, because my theory, this is with my typewriter sales hat on, was that if I could make friends with all the sysadmins and they needed, their companies would need another Unix workstation because they were aware when some department would call them up and say, hey, we need another server, another workstation, they knew about it even before their purchasing officer did. And so they would throw me the business because, of course, I was their friend supporting their Unix user group meetings and this kind of thing.
Right.
Well, of course, as I mentioned, I found myself working out of my wife's sewing closet, so the strategy didn't actually work as well as as the plan or the theory. But in that period of time, I got to know these guys, and I spent a lot of time with them, and I would write this newsletter, and I would ask them for what are the stories I should write in my newsletter that the major computer magazines, Computer World or InfoWorld or Byte magazine, were not covering, that they would like to know about, and what they were talking about. This is now 1992, 93. They talked about free software. And so I would ask them, well, you know, what companies should I call to interview about this free software stuff? And they said, well, because it's free software, as in no-cost software, no company is offering it. And I was saying, well, if you guys really like this stuff, if the benefit to you guys is that you're getting source code and binaries, and you're getting it under a license that allows you to modify it, which means, and these were the engineers who were explaining this to me, that the value of what was then called free software is now called open source software. The value wasn't that it was better, faster, or even cheaper software. It's not that it was free. It was that for the first time, these engineers had control over the software they're using. They actually got source code, and they got it with a license that allowed them to make changes to it. And as a typewriter salesman, what you are always looking for as a salesman is you're looking for a product that customers need that they can't find anywhere else. Because then it's easy. I mean, all of us salesmen, you know, scratch the surface of us, and you'll find that we're all inherently lazy, which is why we become salesmen. You know, the image of a salesman is someone who plays golf all day. Okay, so you know, that's what attracts us into the sales profession. So you're always looking for a product that's really easy to sell so you don't have to work very hard. And I was no different. And what I realized talking to these engineers, when they would tell me that no company was offering them free software, offering them support on free software, but yet they could articulate very clearly why having control over the software gave them a benefit that they couldn't get with software that they would buy from Oracle or SAP or IBM or Microsoft. As a typewriter salesman, I go, holy cow, here's a hole in the market. Here's a benefit I can deliver to customers where I don't have any competitors. No one else in the software business believes that they can make any money selling free software. And, of course, I came out of the hardware business and the hardware leasing business, and I was too dumb to know that you couldn't make money selling free software. So that was the... that was the foundation of the company that became Red Hat. Was we said, wow, if there's a customer need and I have a way of solving that customer need, I should be able to build a business around serving my customers better than Oracle and Microsoft are able to serve the same customers.
So what you did with Red Hat when you started was that you bundled all the different Linux parts that were out in the market into one big usable package.
In effect,
was that your innovation?
Our innovation at Red Hat, the particular innovation, is we understood in a way that most other companies to this very day who sell and try and sell services around open source don't seem to understand, is what we understood is the benefit of Linux was not that it was better or faster or cheaper software. We understood the benefit was it gave the customer control over the technology they were doing. So the unique thing we were doing at Red Hat was committing to delivering every line of code we wrote as open source software. So Red Hat to this very day does not distribute proprietary software. But just to back up and give your listeners a sense of how this works, the way to think about Linux is there's no such thing as the Linux operating system. It's a little bit in the same way there's no such thing as a car. You and I don't drive a car to work. We drive a Saab, or we drive a Volvo. We drive a specific car that a car company assembled out of all the parts that come out of the very creative auto parts industry. Your lamps come from Bausch, and your transmission comes from TRW, and you know, various people make various parts of your car, and the car company designs and assembles the car. So that's what Red Hat's role was, is we assembled some 800 different packages of software from 800 or 900 different engineering teams around the world into a usable product, being the Red Hat Linux operating system. Linux itself is simply the name of the kernel. So if we're shipping a gigabyte worth of operating system software, the kernel might represent 40 or 50 megabytes of that gigabyte of software. It was simply the engine in our car, so to speak. But our job was to turn this, the kernel, the Linux kernel, into a useful operating system. And that's what Red Hat would ship. That's the difference between Red Hat Linux and, say, Novell Linux or Mandriva Linux or Ubuntu Linux. These are all slightly different, what are referred to as distributions, but you think of them as cars. You know, one of these might make a drawing the parallel with cars. One of these might be a minivan, and the next one is a Jeep, and the third one is a sedan, and the fourth one is a sports car. They all have slightly different configurations, and they're typically targeted at slightly different customer needs.
You have to make money.
Yes.
Obviously. So how did you think about that?
Well, what we recognized was in software, in the industry, everyone thought you made money by forcing people to buy your software or, you know, buy an upgrade to your software. And what they didn't seem to recognize, they hadn't spent enough time with their customers. So what the customers were really paying for is what they wanted was a solution. So in our case, we were selling an operating system, and people really didn't want operating systems at all. If they could have gotten away with it, you know, they wouldn't have bought one. But what they did want is they wanted their computers to connect to the internet seamlessly, despite all the changes that were occurring on the internet all the time. And the beauty of operating systems is they evolve forward very quickly. So in Red Hat's case, if we were bundling 800 different packages together to create a copy of 800 of Red Hat Linux, and those 800 packages would update, you know, once or twice a year, for the end user, without Red Hat support, that end user would have to monitor 800 different teams around the world and would have to deal with some two or three updates per day to keep their systems properly secure and properly current. And what we realized is, you know, we didn't have to sell software at all. We could simply sell support. We could make the customer, the users of these Linux operating systems, make their lives so much easier by helping them maintain their servers for them, by providing the services around it, by protecting, if you like, Citibank or Barclays Bank from the rapid change of this technology, by taking responsibility for those changes and delivering those changes on a timely basis, but also on a an invisible basis, so that the user, the customer, didn't have to manage all the updates of his operating system. We would do that for him, and in return, of course, he would send us money.
So here's my observation. So basically, Red Hat worked, and I guess still works, like an aggregator. You look what's out there and you put together what makes sense and make it work together.
Partially, but no, that's not a complete version. So that would be like accusing Volvo or Saab as being an aggregator, and you can be sure the engineers at Volvo or Saab would take exception to that description of their
right.
Clever engineering. But there is no question an element of that to what they do, and there is an element of that to what Red Hat does. That is correct.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, what if I develop my own special open source software, whatever that is, a new word processor or whatever. How would I make money on that one then? Okay. Because will the support need be that big?
Let me query a couple of your assumptions in that question, which is that, you know, people constantly give me hypothetical scenarios, very much like you're doing, and say, how do I make money doing this? I reassure them, saying, well, you probably can't. Because the reality is most new businesses don't succeed. But what's interesting is they all don't succeed for the same reason, which is that they haven't figured out, they haven't gotten inside their customers' heads well enough to understand what the value of what they are doing is to the customer. Because customers are motivated to give you money for one of two reasons. You are either going to help them make more money, or you're going to help them reduce their costs, which in turn makes money. And the reason they're happy to give you money is, of course, if your product or your service helps them make more money, then they have more money and they can afford to give you some of it. And equally, if your product or your service reduces their costs, again, you know, if they reduce their costs, they have more money and they can afford to give you some of it. And that's what you've got to figure out. So, you know, first start with what is it you're doing for the customer that improves your customer's life? Boy, what is the solution? What is the problem your customer has that your product or your service is going to solve? And in Red Hat's case, the problem they are solving is these corporate technology users are building ever more increasingly complex systems around what they are doing. So if you're a bank, you're no longer a bank in Stockholm, you're a European bank with aspirations to go global, and suddenly you not only need to deal with Swedish tax laws and employment laws all the rest of it, regulations, but now you have to deal with European Union regulations, and now you have to deal with Chinese regulations. The systems you are building in your corporation have to get ever more complex, and you need to have control over the technology that you're building these systems around. So when something goes wrong, you can actually fix it, and you're not beholden to your supplier to fix it for you, is becoming an increasingly valuable benefit that Red Hat's corporate customers, but corporate users, software users around the world are running into every day. They need more control over their technology. And the old proprietary model, where as a buyer you buy software but you only get the binaries, the ones and zeros, so you can't make changes to it, but you actually get it under a license that says that software maker will throw you in jail if you even attempt to make changes to the software they've given you. And that model just does not work in an internet-based world where you're trying to build a global corporation that deals with the complexity of the modern world. You have to, as the corporation building out these systems, you have to have control over the software that is behind the systems that you're building. And open source does that for you, and that's why Red Hat financially continues to go from strength to strength.
Let's move on to Lulu. It's a book publishing company where anyone can publish its books.
Yes, but that's not what our mission is. Our mission is to build a marketplace for digital content, is the big vision. So our first implementation of that is primarily in books, and that's what we do best today. But our vision, what we are trying to do, is not limited to books. When I say we're a marketplace of digital content, eBay, for example, is a very, very good marketplace for things. As an old typewriter salesman, I really like the idea that I can buy, you know, antique typewriters on eBay on a regular basis. I do buy antique typewriters on eBay.
Are you a collector?
You know, in a very small way, yes, just because I'm very intrigued by old mechanical objects, because they are computers when you think about it. They're computers only created out of metal levers and gears and ratchets. But, you know, when you press a button in an old mechanical typewriter or calculator, it's exactly the same as a go-to and if-then statement in a computer. So you have computers that can do your calculations, and 100 years ago you had a mechanical object that did the same thing, and they were just remarkably sophisticated mechanical objects, but it was a form of software deployed with mechanical levers and ratchets. Anyway, so I have a particular interest in those things. But my point is that eBay is a marketplace for things. Our problem, or the problem I perceived, is that in a modern internet-based world, where an increasing part of our income as human beings, in advanced economies in particular, but this is true across the planet, an increasing percentage of our income goes towards buying intellectual property. So where our grandparents would occasionally buy, say, a music box, but the vast majority of their disposable income went to buying food or clothing or furniture, today, an increasing percentage of our income is going to buy content on the internet. We buy music, we buy books, we buy movies, we buy software. These are non-tangible goods and assets. And what we saw was the internet is a very, very useful tool for distributing the things that you've created, YouTube, for example. But it is not as effective at getting paid for the content that you're creating. So, you know, it was very easy to film a video and become popular by publishing your video on YouTube. But it's much harder to get paid for the video you're creating on YouTube. And that's really sort of Lulu's bigger vision. Many other companies, of course, are setting up to try and serve the same marketplace. But we're trying to create a marketplace where creators, whether they are individuals like yourself, Thomas, if you do a compilation of the best of the What's Next podcast, and you want to sell it for 20 euros or what do they have in Sweden? Kronar, are they?
Kronar.
20 kronar. You can put it up on Lulu for 20 kronar, and you keep 80% of the revenue for your podcast, and you can sell your podcast both or in all three formats. You can sell it as a digital download, so people can download it and listen to it on their computer. You could transcribe it and sell it as a book, and you know, your customers could buy a physical printed book of your podcast, or you will be able to sell it as a DVD or a CD-ROM, and your customers can buy it and put it into the computer as a CD-ROM without filling up their hard drive with a podcast. So that's what Lulu's doing, is we enable authors like yourself, or for that matter, major corporations like IBM, to put up their content and sell it more efficiently through Lulu than they can selling it through a bookstore or eBay, for that matter.
I listened to a talk you had the other day, and you have very strong opinions about copyright laws and patent systems, and you think they are heavily flawed. So here's the question. Are you in this for the money, or are you in this for the principle to show the world things can be done in a different way?
I'm in it for both. One of my favorite quotes, we all have quotes that we enjoy, and mine is a fellow called over here in the U.S., F. Scott Fitzgerald, a novelist in the 1920s in the U.S. In one of his books, and don't ask me which book, came up with a quote that reads, "The sign of a first-class intelligence is the ability to keep two opposing concepts in mind at the same time and retain the ability to function." And the beauty of the quote is it really does articulate what we should be doing as human beings and compared to what our instincts are. Our instincts are always to simplify. So your question, for example, is an either-or. Are you in it to make the world a better place, or are you in it to make money? And the reality is, most of the best projects that you will ever see do both of those things well. They both make money and they make the world a better place. So there's no question there are some, you know, very large corporations who occasionally do some very anti-competitive things in order to pad their own, you know, bottom line or profits or whatever. But most companies become successful not by doing anti-competitive things or taking advantage of their customers. They become successful by delivering a benefit to customers that their competitors don't deliver. So IKEA is a great example of a company who, you know, I gather the guy who founded IKEA is a Swede who's now one of the world's richest men, which I found astounding.
Right. Ingvar Kamprad.
One of the world's richest men selling cheap furniture. I mean, I talk about an accomplishment of monumental proportions. I'm lost in admiration of this guy. But, you know, I'm also an IKEA shopper. I enjoy the products his company produces, and I think they are very good value for the amount of money you pay for them. What he's doing is he's making, particularly when Nancy and I were younger and we had three kids at home and we had no money and we needed more furniture, and we could get more furniture on our very limited budget by shopping at IKEA, whereas without IKEA we wouldn't have been able to afford the furniture at all. So IKEA made our world a better place in a very measurable way. I could actually calculate how much better my life was as a result of the existence of an IKEA store an hour down the road. And so IKEA does both things well. They both make the world a better place, and they make their founder one of the world's richest men. So if Lulu goes well, Lulu will do both things well. It will both make our authors and our creators more successful, because they will make more money creating new books or new videos or new music, and Lulu will make money helping them become more successful.
can I ask you a question about a current event? Google is launching the Open Handset Alliance, and OS Android is a Linux platform. What is your view on their try to get into the mobile market?
Well, the first rule is I never bet against Google. Those guys are just really, really smart, and they have more money than the rest of the world combined. So, you know, I hesitate to bet against them. Having said that, I'm a little bit skeptical of how they are going about their mobile handset standard approach, because it's not an open technology. They're doing a semi-open technology. So, yeah, it's Linux-based, and some of the pieces are open, but many of the pieces are unnecessarily closed. And what they're hoping is that a highly competitive telecommunications industry will rally around the standards that their mobile device represents. But the moment they make those standards closed, and the moment people have to, you know, buy technology from Google or have to adapt to technology that Google controls, it's going to be a big disincentive for Nokia or for Ericsson or for any of the other Taiwanese mobile device makers to partner with Google, because at the end of the day, how much do they trust Google? So, you know, there are some questions as to whether Google will be successful with this initiative. But as I say, I don't bet against Google. They are very, very smart people.
Here's another question. What do you think of Microsoft's allegation in May that Linux violates over 200 patents?
Well, as I put it with Microsoft, you know, because I'm lost in admiration of Microsoft. They have built a great company, a hugely profitable company. They execute very well. You know, they may come out with, you know, the original versions of Microsoft Word weren't very good, but they worked at it. And now Microsoft Word, hell, even I use Microsoft Word, I hate to admit it. Because it's a good product and it does well. So Microsoft is a well-run company that, you know, creates a lot of value. But whenever I say these things, of course, all my colleagues in the open source world get very nervous about me, thinking I've crossed to the dark side. And I have to admit to them that Microsoft may do evil things. It's just that they do them so well. You have to admire them. And their efforts to discredit Linux is one of those things that they do very well. Fortunately, to this very date, they've been doing this now for 10 years, and they've yet to do it very successfully. And it's sort of more of a rear guard action. If you think of an army who's in retreat, but they're trying to stop the army who's chasing them from capturing their generals or their flag or, you know, capturing their army, they will put up a defense as they retreat. And a lot of these Microsoft initiatives against Linux, you know, strikes me as a very defensive reaction. They are simply trying to stop Linux from gaining market share any faster than Linux already is gaining market share.
But do you think this talk about the patent violations will lead to anything, or is it just talk?
Keep in mind, the whole patent thing is a nuclear minefield. If you remember the old Cold War, where the Russians had all the nuclear bombs and the Americans had lots of nuclear bombs, and they kept building more nuclear bombs. And their theory to it was, if they had more nuclear bombs than the other guys did, the other guys wouldn't start a fight because they had more nuclear bombs. But both of them understood full well that the moment the first guy actually dropped even one bomb, both sides lost. So it was nuclear deterrence. Neither of them could actually use any of their nuclear bombs because they couldn't afford to use one because the other guys would use theirs and they'd both lose. Well, that's the issue with patents for companies like Microsoft. If Microsoft tries to enforce their patents against Linux, Linux now is supported by everyone from Red Hat to IBM to Oracle, and they've built a big consortium of patent holders around the Linux operating system. And so if Microsoft tries to enforce patents against Linux, there's a whole bunch of people who will start enforcing patents against the Microsoft operating systems. And neither side.
Exactly, so you keep the terror balance.
Spend the next two decades in court.
We should wrap this up. I have to ask you, what is the key takeaway for an entrepreneur from what you have learned so far?
Those are twofold. One is and they're actually related. So I'll start with the second one first, which is stay in the field that you enjoy. In other words, pick a market or a niche that you enjoy working in. In my case, it was technology. Because even if, you know, it's the old English adage, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try and try again. Because the point is, every time you try, you become smarter. You learn more about your marketplace. You learn more about your customers. So even if you fail, if your next initiative is in the same marketplace, you're less likely to fail because you're going to be smarter about what works and what doesn't work in that marketplace. And so related to that is stay very close to your customer. In other words, don't define your product by what you like or don't like. There's no question, you better like your product. It's a lot easier to get out of bed in the morning and go to work for a failing business if you actually enjoy the product or the service you're offering. But stay close to your customer. Understand why people are buying the product and what you can do for the people who are buying your product so that they will like your product or your service even more the next day. But again, combined with this first thing of you know, focus on a particular industry, because you know eventually you'll be very, very good at it if you just keep working at it hard enough. So, and I think of my competitive advantage at this point is that I'm no longer 25 years old, and I'm now 50 years old, and I have a better sort of understanding of how to do things than when I was 25. So now when I start Lulu, I no longer think in terms of it being a high risk initiative. I think of it as just, you know, sort of being a process as to how to build a successful company. It's no longer a question of if Lulu will be successful. It's simply, when will it be successful and how successful will it be?
Thank you very much, Bob Young, for taking the time to appear on What's Next.
Congratulations on the good job you're doing with What Next. What you guys are doing in the blogosphere or podcasting a sphere in your case is of massive value to people who, you know, otherwise don't get access to content that the existing publishing industry just doesn't have the bandwidth to deliver.
And that says Bob Young, founder and former CEO of Red Hat and founder of Lulu.com. And just a short reminder to you who listens, check out What's Next Facebook group if you want to know who else is listening to this podcast. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm Thomas Wenström. Have a great day.